Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today we'll hear the first half of a fine talk by journalist Jeremy Scahill. It's about the life, radicalization, and death of Anwar al-Awlaki. It's also about the out-of-control national security state. And it's about prostitute American journalists that choose to serve the powerful rather than hold them to account. I hope you'll stay tuned. Independent journalist Jeremy Scahill has published a new and good book called Dirty Wars. In a speech this past June, he talked about a few of the things he learned during this project. He tells the history of American citizen Anwar al-Awlaki. The more horrible Bush's global war on terror became, the more radicalized Awlaki became. Finally, President Obama had Awlaki assassinated. And he later assassinated Awlaki's 16-year-old son, for good measure. To Scahill, to tell the story of Awlaki and of the U.S. war machine, you have to also talk about the U.S.'s corrupt prostitute news media, which dedicates itself to serving established power rather than challenging it. We will carry Scahill's talk in two installments, today and next week on New World Notes. In today's part, Scahill starts with the prostitute Washington Press Corps. Then he begins the story of Anwar al-Awlaki. Here is Jeremy Scahill.
It's an incredible moment that we're living in right now. There's a war on journalists in this country and around the world. And there's a war on whistleblowers. And at present, that war against whistleblowers and against journalists is being directed by our constitutional law professor, Nobel Peace Prize winning Democratic president. And it is not just against American journalists and U.S. whistleblowers, but it's also against journalists internationally, and I'm going to talk about some of that tonight. But what we've seen with the revelations that were presented by the leaking of Edward Snowden is that there is a huge national security state in this country that is engaged on any given day in acts that may be legal under U.S. law because they've been rubber-stamped by the Congress, but may quite well be unconstitutional and certainly are immoral. And so serious questions are presented about how people should respond to this, not just in media or in government, but how all of us should be responding to this. And I look forward to hearing from Glenn Greenwald, who really is at the center of this right now. And of course, it's so predictable, the attempts to smear Glenn, to dig into his personal life, to go after him, because that's what happens to people who actually stand up when it matters. If you look at the case of Thomas Drake, the NSA official who tried to actually blow the whistle from within the system, what all of these pundits and government officials are saying Edward Snowden should have done. Thomas Drake had his life and his career ruined for doing everything they told him to do, sending his concerns up the chain of command, and they went after him. And they charged him under the Espionage Act. President Obama, under his administration, has gone after more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act than all of his predecessors over the past 100 years. He is targeting whistleblowers in an unprecedented manner. At a time when journalists' phone records are being seized, when the electronic communications of tens of millions of Americans and hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people around the world are having their data seized on any given moment. What is the end game of this? What is the point? What is it that the state is doing right now? What the state is saying is that only official leaks will be tolerated. And we all know that Washington runs on official leaks. There's this caviar correspondent culture in Washington where everybody's friends with everybody else. The journalists hang out with the government officials and the heads of private corporations. Their kids go to fancy schools together. They do super soaker fights on the lawn of Joe Biden's house on the weekend. That's actually a true story. Journalists get invited over to Joe Biden's house to play super soaker. Good old Chuck Todd and the boys from MSNBC. So you have these stenographers that are given official leaks, like in the aftermath of the raid on Osama bin Laden's compound in Abbottabad. Almost everything that was leaked to journalists by John Brennan and others turned out later to be false, that Osama bin Laden was hiding behind one of his wives, that he was reaching for a gun when he was shot. All of the leaks were intended to make the White House look like this was a spectacular, clean victory, and that they took out this murderous mastermind of 9/11, Osama bin Laden. And so seldom are the occasions when the stenographer crowd in Washington actually asks a tough question that this is largely how business is done. When the White House wants something out, they will leak it to one of the friendly journalists, and then they will write the Hallmark postcard to saving the day for peace, freedom, and democracy under Democrats and Republicans. Or when they want to whip up a threat, as in the case with the lead up to the Iraq War, they know which journalists to call because they're going to print what they want, and then they can go on Meet the Press and say, well, look at what Judy Miller printed, it must be true. And that's how this whole thing works. But then when you have people like Glenn Greenwald, who are not the recipients of those official leaks, and instead are developing and cultivating their own sources. Or maybe a whistleblower is going to them because they know that they're not part of the Caviar Correspondents Association, that they actually believe that the role of journalists is to hold those in power accountable, not to facilitate their propaganda. When Glenn Greenwald does something like that, not only does the government come raining down on him, but journalists from the Caviar Correspondents Association are so disgusted with the fact that someone would get a leak that wasn't them, that they pile on. The message that the state is sending is that journalists are only allowed to print official statements, whether they are from public officials saying them publicly, or it's being stated in off-the-record briefings or in strategic leaks. They are trying to criminalize real journalism. They are trying to criminalize whistleblowing. And this has sent a chill through the community of reporters who cover national security issues, and it has sent a chill through the community of people who work within government that were considering speaking up. If journalism is criminalized, and if whistleblowing is criminalized, then how can we say that we have a free press in this society? It means we don't actually have a free press. It means that something that is enshrined in the Constitution, the right to a free press, actually doesn't matter. And I think we're at a moment right now, because of who the president is, where we risk this becoming a permanent reality in this country. We all know that under Bush and Cheney, they were engaged in warrantless wiretapping, their foreign policy looked like Murder Incorporated. There was certainly a war against journalists and a war against dissent, but it's easy to be against those policies when cartoonish villains like Bush and Cheney are in office. When your actual principle is tested, meaning what you actually believe, is when someone like President Obama is in office, when it's the liberals that are sending you the hate mail, when you have the tenacity to continue on and say, you know what, this is a principle, not a partisan game. This isn't a game at all. This has everything to do with the future, not only of this country, but with the stability and independence of nations around the world. I believe that journalists have an obligation to stand up and defend one another when any of them are under attack. And what has happened to Glenn and other journalists who have dared to report outside of the consensus of the Washington clique is reprehensible. And journalists should be ashamed of themselves. I want to tell you a story about one drone strike that was followed by another drone strike 2 weeks later. And I'm going to ask you to just bear with me to explain why I think this is important. I want to say at the onset that I believe that American lives are not worth a penny more than non-American lives around the world. But you can gauge how a society is going to view people that are not its citizens by how it's treating its citizens, and the lengths to which it will go to kill or deny rights to its own citizens speaks volumes to how it views the rest of the world. And for that reason, I want to tell you the story about some American citizens that were killed by their own government. Because to me, it speaks to a much bigger issue about who we are as a society and what this administration is doing with its foreign policy. On September 30th, 2011, President Obama was faced with a decision. And that decision was whether or not to pull the trigger on an operation that he knew would result in the killing of an American citizen who had not been charged with a crime. And for President Obama, the decision was an easy one, and he authorized that strike. And on September 30th, 2011, President Obama authorized a drone strike in the north of Yemen that killed an American citizen named Anwar al-Awlaki. Alongside al-Awlaki in that attack was another American, a Pakistani-American named Samir Khan. And those two were killed in this operation authorized by President Obama. That afternoon, President Obama spoke at Fort Myer. And he said that a dangerous terrorist, Anwar al-Awlaki, was killed today in Yemen. He didn't say that the United States killed Anwar al-Awlaki. He just said that he was killed in Yemen. And he identified him as being the head of external operations for al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, a label that no journalist I know and no Yemeni I know had ever heard applied to Anwar al-Awlaki before. Now, who was Anwar al-Awlaki? I'm sure many people have seen the YouTube videos of him, where he's wearing a camouflage jacket in front of a black flag, calling for armed jihad, saying, I call on the youth in the West to either rise up in their own countries or to join us and the Mujahideen in the fronts of jihad around the world. And he was specifically calling on people to attack the United States in acts of armed violence. No question about that. And that's 99.9% of the story that's presented when anyone talks about Anwar al-Awlaki. But who was Anwar al-Awlaki, and how did he get to become the guy in front of that YouTube video with the camouflage jacket and the black flag? Al-Awlaki's story, in many ways, is an American story. It's a fascinating one. Al-Awlaki was born in 1971 in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And he was born in New Mexico because his father, Nasser al-Awlaki, was a Fulbright scholar who came to the United States in 1966. And he shared with me the essay that he wrote when he was accepted into that program and came to the U.S. to get his education. And he said, I come from a place that has no name. He was from Southern Arabia at the time, and it was in flux in the 1960s. And the region he was from actually did not have an identifiable name as a nation state. And he said, I view America as an inspiration to the world. And its progressive spirit is what makes me want to come there for my education. And he spoke about wanting to build a family and raise them in the image of the history he had read about the United States of America. Now, if you read some of the books of Haymarket books, it's clear that maybe he wasn't reading that history. But he certainly was reading the history many of us are raised on in this country. So fair game to Dr. Nasser al-Awlaki for having read that history. So he comes to the United States and he goes to New Mexico and he gets his degree and then he brings his young wife over to the United States, and his plan was to spend his life in America. And in 1971, his first child is born, Anwar. And he said, you know, at that time, it was legal to hand out cigars in the hospital. And he said, I handed out cigars with It's a Boy on them to everyone. And he starts raising his son. And Anwar's first language was English. And they're moving around according to his academic pursuits. They're in New Mexico. Then they're in Minneapolis, Minnesota, when he's at the university. And his wife, Saleha, gets her GED and is working at a candy factory to support her husband while he's getting his education. And their plan is to build their family and keep them in the U.S. But then Nasser al-Awlaki was offered an opportunity to come back to Yemen and to help with funding from the United States government to start a Department of Agricultural Engineering in Sana'a. So he moves his family back there in the early 1980s. And Anwar is raised among the elites in Yemen, all of the diplomats' kids, the children of the dictator of Yemen. They all go to these elite schools, and English remains his primary language. His father goes on to become a major figure at the university. And when Anwar graduates from high school, he decides to go back to the United States to get his college education. And he goes out to Colorado, and it was just as the so-called Gulf War was beginning. And he was never a particularly political guy and was not a religious guy. But he got involved with anti-war organizing on the campus in Colorado and started to speak out against the Gulf War. He was invited at one of these meetings that he was going to with anti-war organizing to speak at a mosque in Denver. And he goes and gives a speech at the mosque, and the imam at the mosque said, you know, you have a real gift for speaking. I think you should consider coming back here every Friday. And sometimes we'll let you lecture and you can work with young people. And Anwar gets totally taken with this new identity of himself as a young Muslim and decides that he wants to become an imam. And so he veers away from the university studies and starts engaging in studying of Islamic scholarship. And he ultimately becomes an imam. In fact, I was just in Minneapolis the other day, and I met a young woman who's Somali that told me that she had been a member of Anwar Awlaki's mosque in the early days, and she said the thing that drew a lot of us there were his sermons on racism, that he was often quoting Malcolm X, and that he was visiting a lot of prisoners and doing support for the families of people who were in prison. I've met other people that were at his mosques in those early days too, and all of them talked about him being very, very sharp on racial politics, and that was one of the main themes of his sermons. He ends up getting transferred to a mosque in San Diego and ultimately ends up in Washington, D.C., actually in Falls Church, Virginia. And on 9/11, he was the imam at a large Islamic center, the Dar al-Hijra Mosque. And when 9/11 happened, Anwar Awlaki became a sort of media celebrity in the United States. Not among the alternative media, but the corporate media. And the reason he was a celebrity is because he would be interviewed on NPR or profiled in the Washington Post or interviewed on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, because what he was saying is, I condemn the terrorists who committed the 9/11 attacks, and I believe that Al-Qaeda is perverting the religion of Islam. But he also was calling for caution against criminalizing the religion of Islam, and was condemning the attacks that were happening against the Muslim community in the United States. He became a guy that for the corporate media was helping to make sense of the experience of many American Muslims in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. In fact, he was considered to be such a mainstream member of society that he was invited by the Pentagon to be the keynote speaker at a Pentagon luncheon soon after 9/11. And just to give you a sense on how bad the intelligence was at the time of the Pentagon, one of the things that they served at this luncheon was a bacon sandwich when Imam Anwar Awlaki was speaking to them. Awlaki, though, while he was speaking in public and saying, he went so far as to say that the United States had a right to go into Afghanistan militarily to pursue those responsible for 9/11, which was very much in sync with the mainstream of American popular opinion at the time. Anwar Awlaki, though, was dealing with something else behind the scenes, and that was that he was being investigated and interrogated by the FBI. He was hearing the stories of Muslims that would come into his mosque about their businesses being vandalized. One woman, soon after 9/11, a Muslim woman from his community, was beaten in a hate attack with a baseball bat and stumbled into the mosque. 1,200 Muslims were detained around the United States in the aftermath of the attacks. Muslim charities were targeted. Muslim-owned businesses were visited by the FBI. We now know part of the extent to which the CIA was working with the NYPD in targeting Muslim restaurants and Muslim establishments. This was happening in a very intense way after 9/11, and Awlaki was dealing with it. And they were questioning him about the fact that some of the 9/11 hijackers had come to sermons at his mosques. And they were trying to see if there was a link between Awlaki and the 9/11 hijackers. And Awlaki was under this tremendous pressure from the U.S. government. And he was responding to many of the people coming into his mosque and hearing their stories at a time when the U.S. was gearing up to invade Iraq. And he started to become politicized in a very different way. And his sermon started to take on a sharper tone. And ultimately, he decided that he wanted to leave the United States. So he goes to Britain for a while, and then back to Yemen, and he thinks he wants to go and pursue more courses in Islamic scholarship when he's back in Yemen. While he's there, his sermons are becoming more and more popular around the world because he's weaving in stories about racial politics. He was talking about the witch hunts in the black community and immigrant communities in Britain. He was tying them to Quranic verses and stories from the Quran and talking using pop cultural references that resonated with a lot of young people. And his sermons started to pop up in investigations into terror plots in Britain, the United States, and Canada. And the U.S. began to put pressure on the Yemeni government to silence Anwar al-Awlaki because of his speech at the time. And al-Awlaki continued to record these sermons, and they were being sold in CDs, and then when the internet started to become the internet, they were getting downloaded. And in 2006, al-Awlaki is arrested in Yemen and put in prison on trumped-up charges that he had intervened in a tribal dispute. These were charges by the Yemeni government. And he spent 18 months in prison, 17 of them in solitary confinement. The FBI came and interrogated him while he was in that prison, and the United Nations investigated it and determined that his incarceration was extra-legal. So Anwar al-Awlaki was, in a sense, a political prisoner. He was in that prison at that point. There were no allegations that he had been involved with any terror plots. They didn't like what he was saying. They said, well, his sermons are inspiring young Muslims in the West to engage in terror plotting. But there was no concrete evidence he was involved with anything. He believed firmly that the United States was directly responsible for his imprisonment. During the course of my reporting, I was able to discover that he was right. There was a meeting after al-Awlaki was arrested in 2006 between John Negroponte, who at the time was the director of national intelligence, and of course a man who knows a tremendous amount about dirty wars from his time in Central America during the 1980s. And Negroponte told a senior Yemeni official that it was the position of the United States that Anwar al-Awlaki should remain in prison for 4 or 5 years so that people will forget about him. So here you have a senior U.S. official telling an official from what is effectively a client state, keep one of our citizens in your prison for 4 or 5 years so that the world forgets about him, knowing damn well that there were no real charges against him. And so while al-Awlaki is in prison, the only books that they really made available to him were the Quran and Dickens and Shakespeare. He hated Shakespeare. He said Shakespeare was an imperialist. He loved Dickens and was fond of comparing characters from Dickens' novels to figures within the U.S. and Yemeni governments. But if you review his prison writings, he was radicalized in prison and came out a totally changed man. When he was released from prison, after 18 months, it was because of pressure from his family and civil liberties groups from around the world and within Yemen. He comes out of prison and starts a blog called Imam Anwar's Blog. And on that blog, he develops a relationship with young Muslims around the world. And you could see he starts to take a very sharp tone opposing what the United States was doing in the world, particularly in the Islamic world. He was deeply affected by Abu Ghraib and by Guantanamo, and by the lies that led the United States into the war in Iraq, and by the torture of people in countries around the world, and by the rendition flights. And he starts to become sharper and sharper in the debate about suicide bombing and whether it's permissible under the teachings of the Quran. And the United States all the while is putting pressure on the Yemeni government to arrest Anwar al-Awlaki. And eventually, al-Awlaki's life becomes so infested with intelligence agents that he leaves the capital of Sana'a in Yemen and goes to the south of the country. And while he's in the south of the country, he's in the area that his tribe controls in Shabwa province. And the United States is desperate to get him back to a place where they could force him back into prison. And so al-Awlaki's own father, Nasser al-Awlaki, who was close with the U.S. government, agrees that he will go down and meet with his son because the family had been told, if you do not put al-Awlaki back into the custody of Yemen's intelligence services, the Americans are going to kill him with a drone. This is before any terror plots he was alleged to have been involved with took place. This is in the spring of 2009. His father goes down and says to Anwar, I want you to come back to Sana'a because the Americans are going to kill you if you don't. And al-Awlaki says to him, I was born free and I'm going to die free, and I'm not going to let the Americans tell me which way to position my bed. And so that's the last time his father ever spoke to him. His father then leaves and Anwar is there. In November of 2009, Dr. Nidal Hassan opens fire in Fort Hood, Texas, on his fellow soldiers and kills 13 of them and wounds many, many others. He's paralyzed himself in the operation. And within 24 hours of that shooting happening, a story was leaked in the media that Anwar al-Awlaki had been in email touch with Nidal Hassan. And to this day, the story persists that Anwar al-Awlaki had directed the Fort Hood shooting. But the emails have now been declassified. And if anything, they show that Nidal Hassan was sort of a creepy stalker of Anwar al-Awlaki. He was trying to give him a $5,000 prize. He asked al-Awlaki to help him find a wife. Al-Awlaki almost offered no responses to Nidal Hassan whatsoever. And U.S. law enforcement has actually said there's nothing to indicate al-Awlaki had anything to do with that plot, except the fact that, like hundreds and hundreds of other people around the world, he was receiving emails from this guy. But nonetheless, the story persists that al-Awlaki was directed, in some cases it's reported, or was involved with the Fort Hood shooting. Al-Awlaki, though, sealed his own fate in a way a short time later when he published a blog post that said Nidal Hassan was a hero. And he called on other Muslims in the U.S. military to do what Nidal Hassan did and to kill American soldiers that are going to be deploying in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is a little bit of a sidebar, but I think this is interesting. Do you know what Nidal Hassan's profession was? He was a psychiatrist. And do you know that Nidal Hassan, who did something absolutely reprehensible, but Nidal Hassan was a psychiatrist who was treating soldiers who were fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he was listening to their stories of what they were doing in those war zones. And he tried to report them up his chain of command and recommended that some of them be tried for war crimes. That's the guy who shot all those soldiers. So, you know, I'm not defending what he's doing. I'm saying all of these stories have a backstory. No one becomes who they are in a vacuum. The story of what happened to Nidal Hassan is in a way similar to what happened to Anwar al-Awlaki. They didn't just pop out of nowhere, read the Quran, and decide, I'm going to shoot some people. There were things that happened, and in this case of these people that I'm talking about, things that happened that the U.S. government was directing that helped create the people that they became. So al-Awlaki praises this act by Nidal Hassan, and that, for many Americans, I think was enough to say, Anwar al-Awlaki is a terrorist. That's really when the campaign started to say, you know, this guy is a terrorist and he's dangerous. That was the last blog he wrote. The CIA shut down his website, and al-Awlaki was forced to go underground.
Jeremy Scahill. And here we will have to pause for this week. Next week, the U.S.'s secret war on Yemen, the courageous Yemeni journalist who exposed the horrendous civilian casualties and was persecuted by the Obama administration, the killing of al-Awlaki and later his son, and violent events closer to home, including Sandy Hook and the Boston Marathon. Yes, Scahill weaves all of this together. For more on New World Notes, please see our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimae non carborundum, and reminding you that war is not healthy for children and other living things. Ciao.